Welcome to the Social Network Show. How do you feel about social technology and this connected, networked world we live in? Your host of the Social Network Show, Dr. J, interviews informed and entertaining guests to tackle the most pressing digital issues of interest to business professionals and nonprofit leaders, to parents and educators, and to anyone wondering where all this is taking us. And now, your host, experimental psychologist, Dr. Jane Karwoski.
Every product today seems to tout its Bluetooth or Wi-Fi connectability, but beware. Such conveniences come at a high cost. Fortunately, there are professionals in the information security or InfoSec field who see the magnitude of this risk for public safety and human life. In our preceding episode, you heard about IamTheCavalry.org from Josh Corman. Today, you'll be introduced to his partner in reducing cybercrime through Better InfoSec, Bo Woods. Bo, welcome to the Social Network Show.
Thank you.
I would love to hear about your background in general and in IT security. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, sure. So I actually graduated from Georgia Tech with an undergrad degree in psychology. So kind of an interesting quirk about somebody being in a high-tech field with a psychology background. I'm sure you know how that goes.
Georgia Tech does a lot of experimental psych. Was that your area?
My focus was on industrial and organizational psychology. So a lot of that was actually things like human device interaction, not necessarily digital devices, but it could even be, a cup or a door and how the design of the thing should be intuitively recognized by the user in how to accomplish their goal.
Yeah, like the design of everyday things.
That's a great book. Don Norman.
Don Norman, yep. Yeah. What an interesting guy.
He is, yeah.
And the psychology of everyday things, because I know the acronym is POET, P-O-E-T. Psychology.
I think the book changed names at some point, and I don't remember whether the current name is psychology or design. But yeah, it's really interesting how it's interrelated, and the functionality comes through in the design and some of the best well-made products throughout the centuries, not just in technology or what we now consider technology, which is computer powered and always connected. But even in, technology like chairs, you just sit down and it's either comfortable or it's not comfortable. And depending on how you want to design it, you can go either way. I've been at coffee shops that I swear the chairs are not comfortable because they just want you to get up and leave and somebody else to come in and sit down.
Well, yeah, that might not invite you to come again.
Very true.
But and I've heard engineers, have a motto, design it so that it cannot be used in any other way but the one you want, because people will find some way to mess it up or do something different with it. But okay, I'm so sorry. I got us off on
a tangent
pretty early in your story. So please continue.
Yeah. So after I graduated college, I ended up working in the IT field. I was doing computer support at a hospital and eventually wound up as part of their information security team. Then I joined a consulting organization and started working in broader fields, information security across multiple industries. I've been doing that for about the last 7 years. And I started seeing the same mistakes repeated in different industries and not a lot of learning from others what really works and what doesn't. It was to the point where that was distracting from my ability to actually give people good advice, because I kept feeling like, well, I gave the other people this advice and it didn't work for them, or they didn't implement it. So, how do I go farther and go further? And looking at that kind of on a macro scale, we spend about, I think this year is going to be somewhere between $70 and $80 billion a year on security services and products. And where that money is not being spent in other sectors of the global economy, it's being spent to secure the IT infrastructure that we've got. really makes you wonder and ask what value we're getting out of it as a society. When you see things like, you know, a breach a day, it seems like this year, of personally identifiable information or credit card numbers or, you know, healthcare information or things like that. And so a couple of years ago, when I was at one of the major security conferences out in Las Vegas, B-Sides Las Vegas, I ran into Josh and, we started talking, and he was telling me a little bit about the I Am the Cavalry initiative that he had launched. I told him a story that was, when I was at the hospital, we had one of the set of computer systems there that, was actually a medical device. It was a fetal heart monitor to monitor the, patient status of prenatal babies or babies that were born premature. Those healthcare devices, the medical devices, were actually infected with some kind of malicious software. It wasn't intending to do anything harmful to the patients. You know, it wasn't a targeted attack. It was actually trying to steal banking passwords to go and exfiltrate money from people's accounts. But it still managed to hit those medical devices. And through a lack of being able to get support at some of the typical ways you would, calling the manufacturer and doing some of the easy things, it ended up that put together a case to take to the CEO of the hospital to be able to essentially take back those devices, to get control back from the malicious software that was running on them. So I ended up using some hacking software to break in the same way that the malicious software did, to get rid of the malicious software and then reboot the system so that the doctors could go back to using them, so they didn't have to have extra nursing staff and put patient safety at risk. And as I was telling Josh this story the first time we met, it occurred to me that, you know, throughout my 8 to 10 years in doing security, I probably had the most effect on that first project that I work on as a security person, which was on those medical devices. And so the message of I Am the Cavalry really resonated with me to a degree that I think a lot of other types of groups, organizations, and causes really never did.
Mm-hmm. Because you could see some actual really crucial problem that you were able to solve.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. I had spent 3 years in the healthcare field living the things that Josh was talking about. And so when he was able to really capture that and play it back to me really well, the life that I had seen, and I realized that the impact that could happen, going one way or another, either helping to build security and preserve patient safety, or to potentially neglect security if it wasn't seen as a safety issue. I saw that the right choice was to work for better safety of patient devices, of automotive devices, cars, of some of the critical infrastructure, and some of the other things that the Cavalry focuses on. So it really kind of spoke to me at a human way. I like to say it's the intersection of connected technology and humanity.
And that is the purpose of I Am the Cavalry in public safety and human life, because right. Our connected technologies, I'm learning your vocabulary, our connected vocabulary, our connected technologies are spreading faster than our ability to secure them in an information security sense. Mm-hmm. In other words, make them safe for people to use. So we're all getting more and more of these connected devices, not realizing probably that they really are not safe or secure. They are very vulnerable. They're very vulnerable to attacks or infiltration and so forth. Now, that name, I know that when Josh and others first started forming this concept and were motivated to work on it, they say that they searched high and deep in positions of power and government and influence and found out that they're just didn't seem to be, there's nobody coming to help us. There is no cavalry on the way, folks. Now, what that fascinates me, though, because what does that mean? They went to see people who, to all reasonable expectation, would be interested and involved in making these secure and less vulnerable. But what did they find?
Right. So, you know, at a certain level of expertise and experience in our industry, we get called upon to advise government organizations, non-government organizations, commercial enterprises, you know, the backbone of the internet, a lot of these different organizations, manufacturers, policymakers, and others. And, you know, at a certain point, you just realize that they're calling us in to ask us what to do. Because they're getting, you know, 10 different answers from 10 different people that they ask. Not all of those answers are always technically literate. You know, sometimes it's from, someone who's studied public policy their entire career. And that's not a bad thing, but in areas as deeply technical, and as kind of new as this, you have to have a good technically literate voice of reason to kind of be able to be an ambassador from the security or the technology arena to be able to come into those discussions and to be able to find a common way forward. So I think the way that I usually describe that is, you know, we looked around for the adults in the room and we found that we were them, and that scared the hell out of us. So we knew we had to do something. We had to do it fast. Because if you know our industry at all, you know that we don't exactly pride ourselves on being adults. We like to feel like kids. We like to have a lot of fun. So, you know, when we're the ones that are called upon, make decisions and to help inform and influence decisions at the magnitude and level that, some of the ones we were being asked to inform were at, it really makes you realize that there is a great need for this. And so then Josh and his co-founder, Nicholas Prococo, and myself and others have been trying to engage with the security research community, with the technology community, and help them become ambassadors to the rest of the outside world, who is, you know, right now, everyone is dying for what we know. Dying to be able to get access to our knowledge, our experience, those types of things. And they're very ready for that, where in the past, I think we've kind of been the weird people playing with computers sitting off in the basement. Uh-huh. And it's not that way anymore. So, after, you know, a decade or more of, kind of getting hit on the nose when we try and bring up problems and issues, now we have the chance. But to some degree, we don't give ourselves the permission, even though we have already been given permission by the outside world to influence that change.
Okay, so you're basically training the trainer.
We're trying to do some of that, yes. You know, right. It goes both ways. So with I Am the Cavalry, our biggest thing is outreach and education of our own cohort, our own group of experts, right. But also engaging with policymakers, engaging with manufacturers, engaging with, you know, governmental agencies and other groups to try and help them have, as their first impression of the security research community, somebody who is willing to work with them, and who is tolerant and understanding and most of all, empathetic to the priorities and concerns that they have without trying to impose our own upon them.
I'm so glad to hear that that window of opportunity has opened and that you are preparing yourselves to go through it. In the second half of today's episode, you'll hear more from Bo Woods of IAmTheCavalry.org. This is your host, Jane Karwoski.
Questions? Comments? Reach out to us. Our email address is questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com or find us on Twitter @SocialNetShow.
The following freebie alert is brought to you by The Social Network Show and Penguin Random House Publishers. You've been hearing about the vulnerability of things connected to the internet. One large category of the Internet of Things, or IoT, is public infrastructure. Hydroelectric dams and power plants of all kinds are part of the infrastructure of modern life. Failure in them or in the grid that directs electric power around countries would, as you can imagine, wreak havoc and end many lives. In his new book, Lights Out, award-winning veteran news anchor and journalist Ted Koppel tells you what this would mean. What would life be like in the days, let alone weeks or months, following a widespread outage in the United States? As an example, picture this. By the end of the first week, emergency rations have been depleted. Hundreds of the elderly and infirm have already died. Hundreds of thousands of refugees have inundated states where the power is still on. Only the military can maintain a semblance of order, and there aren't enough troops to go around. With no federal plan for a widespread power outage lasting more than a week, you and millions of others are essentially on your own. The folks at Penguin Random House have kindly provided a couple of free hard copies of Lights Out for our listeners. Please send an email to questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com with your name and preferred email address. By the way, please let us know if you do not wish to receive email updates from the social network station. Please put Lights Out in the subject line. This free offer is on a first-come, first-served basis, so shoot a request to questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com for a free copy of Ted Koppel's book, Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. We will then follow up with the first requests received for mailing instructions so Penguin Random House can send you your copy. You're listening to The Social Network Show. I'm your host, Dr. J, and you are hearing from Bo Woods of IamTheCavalry.org about their efforts to engage, inspire, and help the tech industry to build in security in networked, connected devices. And Bo, you can tell me perhaps more about how the difficulties of maybe becoming a discipline or a part of the workforce happened, and what how that kind of has been something to overcome.
Right. Yeah. So software and computing technology is really young compared to other areas of disciplines, like medicine has been around hundreds of years. Engineering has been around thousands of years. These things are built off a cycle of learning that goes back generations upon generations upon generations. Meanwhile, the computing industry really is less than 100 years old, or just around 100 years old, I think. So we haven't had time to necessarily develop the rigorous set of academic and institutional learning that other industries have. And if you look at terms like software engineer and security engineer, those aren't necessarily reflective of the rest of the engineering world and the rest of the engineering disciplines. If you look at industrial engineering and particularly mechanical or architectural engineering, those have a degree of rigor that is rarely questioned. The amount of things that that folks building bridges know is vast, and it's pretty much always agreed upon, except for some of the edge cases, some of the new things that people are discovering. In software engineering, we really don't have that level of rigor. So I was reading an article the other day that penned the term software engineer to a 1968 international group that got together and wanted to apply the term software engineer as an aspirational title, saying we should have that level of rigor, we should have that generally agreed upon set of background information and knowledge that we're passing on to future generations of software engineers. And so if we go to government agencies or policymakers or those sorts of people, because our title says engineer, they tend to think that there's a standardized body of knowledge that might be tapped into. But that's really not the case. We say if you ask 10 security engineers a question, you'll get 11 different answers. So
that's not very encouraging.
Yeah.
Well, now, before you go on, I just want to throw in here this question that one of the things that I have noticed about computers, knowledge thereof, and so on, is that it seems to be a form of tacit knowledge. It's an informal knowledge. And that's why it is seems like such a black box to so many of us. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's accurate?
I would say that it is. I'd say that a lot of people, whether they're in a professional domain or an amateur domain, learn computers. They learn this new technology from using it, exploring it, and discovering it on their own. And kind of back to one of the things you said early on, engineers tend to build things in a way that they can't be used the wrong way. That's kind of the engineering philosophy. And in the computing philosophy, because it's so new, because it's recently emerged from a hobbyist domain, I think that that has influenced the way computers and the way digital devices work today, which is they will do the thing you want them to if you know how to evoke that particular routine or function or piece of magic. I had a friend of mine say to me the other day, so much of what technology is just seems like magic to me. And when there's people who are doing things with technology, they're doing things with magic. But then along come hackers and they do things to the technology that not even the most technologically savvy people can prevent against. It's like they're these even greater level of wizards. And that was essentially understood hacking and technology and a lot of these things. And I think that there's a parallel there to one of the things Arthur C. Clarke said, which is any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And that certainly carries over to computing technology, to software, and to the digital devices we have.
Very thought-provoking. Now, something you said in there made it sound like the person learning about this is working in isolation. And my impression has been that, like the teenage boys that got into it to begin with, it was very social in a sense that, and I even see this in computer labs on campus, that the quickest way to find out something is just to ask the person next to you, hey, do you know how to do this? Or yeah. Because to wade through the manuals, which are frequently not written by people who think like anybody else.
Right.
Or basically they don't understand and appreciate how much background knowledge they have, and what they're saying depends on knowing this large amount of background knowledge, and they're not writing for, the person who doesn't have it. But any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there are as many ways to come about your individual knowledge of technology as there are people. And that's I think, due to the very personal nature of technology today. You have a phone in your hand. At least I have a phone in my hand that's built on computer technology, and I learn about it largely through exploring it on my own, through asking it, forming hypotheses on my mind, then carrying out experiments with the device to see if what I think will happen happens, and then that reinforces that. That's one way of coming about that knowledge. Another way, like you said, is to ask the person next to you. So I think that there's many, many different ways of doing it. But if you look at some of the early innovators in learning about computing technology, the person next to them wasn't playing with computers. They weren't exploring that world. So it was hard for them to go and be sociable until the advent of some of the online technologies that are now prevalent, to be able to reach out digitally and ask somebody who is your virtual next door neighbor. So that enabled some of that, but it certainly was not the only way to come by that knowledge.
Okay, well, maybe we should get back to the idea of the Internet of Things.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you for going down the garden path there with me. But as far as the risks and vulnerabilities of the things being mm-hmm. connected to the internet or the Bluetooth, et cetera, I am the cavalry, but with the origin of this grassroots movement, the desire is to improve or safeguard or at least introduce the idea mm-hmm. of safety into the automobiles, the homes, the mm-hmm. smart houses, which Georgia Tech, I think, is pretty advanced mm-hmm. on, and medical devices and public infrastructure, right. which, of course, is huge and has tremendous amount of vulnerability and possibility to be hacked to great disastrous results. I've heard about the 5-star guidelines. Can you tell us about that and sure. where it's been implemented?
Yeah. So, you brought up a bunch of different topics there. I'll say that one of our greatest aspirations is not to kind of wag our finger and tell people that they did things wrong. It's to first and foremost make sure that the trust that we already place in those devices is justified. So where safety needs to be an overriding concern, that the computer and connectivity technologies support that safety layer. So there's a lot of things that you can do with computers and with networking that enable things that aren't possible without it. There's a tremendous number of benefits that you can derive from those technologies, which is why they're being used in such safety critical places like medical devices and automobiles. You can also reduce cost. You can increase scale. You can get products to market faster. So there's a lot of good things that you can do with these technologies. We just want to make sure that the trust we place in them as a society is justified trust, right? So you also mentioned the 5-star framework, which is something that we developed for the automotive industry after some deep consultation among security researchers, policymakers, automakers themselves, some insurance companies, and several other different groups. We put together a set of 5 capabilities that, when implemented, give computer systems and cars a much better chance of performing reliably and safely. In doing so, we published this about 18 months ago now, I guess it was. And we first and foremost wanted to recognize the automakers' long track record of building safety into their designs, building vehicles to be safe. If you look at the numbers, it's something like 300,000 or 400,000 people over the last 50 years who have been saved by innovations and technologies that are now built into cars, seat belts, airbags, crash zones, those types of things. But where they're experimenting with new technologies and building in Bluetooth, building in always-on 4G connections, putting multiple computer systems and sensor arrays that talk to each other and then make automated decisions on behalf of the driver, we wanted to make sure, again, that the trust that they're placing in those systems is justified. So our list of 5 capabilities, and we call them capabilities rather than the controls because they really allow cars to go faster and to be more trustworthy, is safety by design. How do you anticipate and avoid failure? The second one is third-party collaboration. How do you work with others acting in good faith to find and report flaws to you? Third one is how do you have some kind of a forensic logging capability, so that when something happens, you can then investigate it or enable a function like the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to perform an investigation so that they can figure out why something went wrong. And then once you know that there are flaws and you know what the better way is, how do you have a secure, prompt, and agile update system so that you can inoculate a fleet of vehicles against known vulnerabilities, known flaws, and known threats? And then finally, how do you isolate and segment failure so that hacking the radio, for instance, can't cause a failure in the braking system? So those five capabilities are ones that, we feel very strongly make for safer products. They're not all technical capabilities. Many of them are process and policy based. So being able to work with researchers, for instance, or hobbyists who are tinkering with their cars and who might discover flaws and report them in good faith rather than suing those people, automakers could acknowledge the findings. They could work with them to discover the root cause issues, and they could work to build an update so that those flaws get fixed in future designs as well as in the current fleet.
I believe Josh mentioned that it, after 15 years, Microsoft has actually developed a reward system for some quite hefty rewards for certain discovering certain types of flaws.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, Microsoft used to be one of the organizations that would sue researchers who reported vulnerabilities. And then they kind of grudgingly came to accept that vulnerabilities are part of the software development lifecycle, right? Vulnerabilities are simply flaws in a human-made system. You know, there's no shame to admit that you're not perfect. At least I'm not ashamed to admit it. But for some reason, when you build something, you want to feel like it's perfect. Okay, maybe not perfect, but at least it doesn't have some type of flaw that could have a catastrophic impact.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's kind of a, I think Josh called it the five stages of grief, which is something
yes.
that Katie Mazuris, one of our friends, came up with, the five stages of vulnerability disclosure grief. And it takes a process. It takes a reckoning internally to go from where Microsoft was 15 or 20 years ago and saying, you know, I think that security researchers are bad for inquiring into the nature of the security of these products, to where now they make critical business decisions based on work that third parties essentially give them for free or for you know, some non-monetary reward in many cases, or large financial rewards in other cases. And they've learned to actually use outside researchers to improve the return on investment on their security spending, as well as to disrupt the underground ecosystems that those security researchers or hackers who want to find a vulnerability for their own financial gain and sell it on the black market. By engaging with the security researchers, you know, the 99-point-something% probably who want to do the right thing, who want to report it and see the flaw fixed, they're able to shift the dynamics of an entire market towards better, safer products. And so I think the words that Josh often uses are, we want to compress that 15 years of learning down to two or three.
Right. Oh, this is such good news to me. Thank you, Bo, for explaining all that. And I want to thank Professor Paul Rosenzweig of Red Branch Consulting. He was my guest on the show a month or two ago, and about his great courses on cybersecurity. And he mentioned IamTheCavalry.org, and I thought, what's that? And I feel that it and you and Josh and everyone associated with that are an answer to a question I didn't even know how to ask. So I really appreciate you and hope that we can continue to collaborate ourselves. I definitely look forward to meeting you and Josh at B-Sides Las Vegas next year, since I'm right here in Las Vegas.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, all the conferences come to me. But that is one I didn't even know about. I knew about DEF CON, and I thought, huh, what's that got to do with me, you know? But you've shown us, and I hope that listeners will go to the website, iamthecavalry.org. Right. And you have needs there. Get involved, I believe, is the tab. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be a programmer to be involved and part of the solution on this. So, again, I thank you very much for your time and for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And thank you, all my listeners, for being with us for this edition of the Social Network Show. I'd love to hear from you, so please get in touch with questions at thesocialnetworkshow.com. And we have an app on iTunes Store or Google Play, so it is called The Social Network Show. And I hope you'll get that and listen to us on iTunes or whatever your podcast platform is, Audio Boom, Rabbit TV, etc., etc. So please have fun and be safe online and off until we welcome you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the worldwide show dedicated to social media networking and understanding the connected, networked world we live in. Listen to our archive shows on thesocialnetworkshow.com and follow us on Twitter at Social Net Show. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia Incorporated. The views and opinions expressed are those of our host and guest and may not be the views and opinions of Social Network Intermedia.